Cultivate Simple, episode 22, Beyond Organic.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your hand. I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend.
Welcome to Cultivate Simple, an honest and unrehearsed discussion about trying to live a more simple life. This is episode 22. 22.
Wow.
And today we are discussing going beyond organic. And sometimes I do have to, I have to mention at the top of the show here that even though it's Cultivate Simple and even though we're trying to discuss living a more simple life, sometimes I don't think our life feels very simple. Sometimes I think, and it's not, I guess, because the opposite of simple is complicated, right? But
right.
And it's not that our life is complicated, but that I just...
It depends on your definition of simple,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And simple doesn't mean that you've got nothing to do. Because well, clearly that's not the case.
That's good, because... then our life is...
I think a lot of times people confuse simple with minimal or minimalistic, mm-hmm. which isn't the case.
Right.
Simple, I think, is more, maybe we should say mindful as mm-hmm. opposed to simple, because that's really kind of...
So should we change it to cultivate mindful?
No, because that's weird.
I just, this week, the past 2 weeks really have been kind of crazy for us. The past 3 days have been just non-stop, and we're ready to stop for a little bit. So it's actually, in one way, it's late on Sunday night, and we're recording this to put it out on Monday, and in one way, it's difficult to sit down and record this.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, well, for instance, today we spent literally the whole day splitting and stacking firewood to get it ready for next year.
Mm-hmm.
And
which you'll see pictures of it on Tuesday on the blog.
Yes.
Because we're using a new stacking method, European.
Well, new to us.
New to us.
And yeah, but after spending a whole day doing that, I want to do nothing more but lay on the couch and finish the book that I need to finish because it's a week overdue from the library. But, you know, in some ways, I guess we complicate our lives in order to somehow achieve simplicity, if that makes sense. Or is that just me being very tired right now?
Your life is just more complicated because I blog and now we have a podcast.
That's true. Why are we doing this? And on that note, if you'd like to support the podcast, if you get any value out of this podcast, feel free to go to cultivatesimple.com and look in the sidebar and help us out. We believe in value for value. And if you're getting any value out of this, then help us out. Last week I asked for 5 new subscribers. We got 1, which we're very happy about.
Better than none, right?
Happy that we got the 1, not happy that we didn't get the 5. But that just really helps us out and helps us out. Man, I am tired tonight. My brain is not functioning. So this might be rough. I apologize in advance, folks. This could be... I might be stammering and stuttering.
It's a good thing I can do a lot of talking on this topic.
Yes, that's very
true. And probably will do most of the talking on this topic since
that's right.
It's kind of my area of my brainchild, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
My thoughts.
Yeah.
And ideas. And
just as a preview of coming attractions, this week, if you listened to the permaculture episode a few episodes ago, Bill and Lauren are going to be coming over and, they're going to be coming over for dinner, but we're going to be interviewing them as well, because we might actually have them do a permaculture design for our land here. I think that I almost think we could pull it off ourselves, but it might be good just to share our ideas with them and get another set of eyes on
it. Like a second opinion.
Yeah, second opinion. just to make sure that we're heading in a direction. And maybe they'll see something that we're just completely missing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we're going to have them over this week and have dinner with them and interview them after dinner about permaculture and just about what that means and a little bit more in depth. So if you didn't listen to the permaculture episode, you might want to, because we're not going to spend a lot of time on the basics, right. Since that's what that episode was about. We're going to go a little bit more in depth with permaculture.
Right. And probably talk about them and their farm and, you know. Right, I think biographies like that are really fascinating, like how people get to be where they are and how they end up doing what they're doing. And we went to yesterday, we should talk a little bit about this. Yesterday we went to the Rural Living Days put on by the County Extension here. And it was like $20 and it was, you know, it started at 9 a.m. and went till 3 and you had 3 different classes you could choose from. And overall, there were probably, what, like 7 to 10 different classes each period that you could choose from. So we signed up for different classes each of the sessions so that we could, you know, listen to as many things as we could and then figured we could share what we learned. We ended up having to go to the same session, the last one, because the other one that we had wanted to go to was full.
So I went
to one on seed saving and the importance of growing open pollinated and heirloom vegetables, and I met the lady that did it. Actually lives right down the road from us, a couple minutes. And so I'm going to try to get in contact with her about, cause the little class with the workshop was really phenomenal. And I think that it might be something that our listeners would be really get into. I mean, she had a lot of great ideas and a lot of interesting, information, and they have a little farm down there, her and her, partner. So, yeah.
Well, and you've done seed saving. About seed saving on your blog, right?
Right, yeah. And I saved some of my own seed. And I mean, she had a lot of really great ideas on why you should focus on growing open pollinated as opposed to hybrids. Mm-hmm. And why you should save a little bit of your own seed just, you know, just to have the skills and stuff. So I think we'll try to get in contact with them maybe and interview them as well, because it was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then we also recorded a session at our library about building ponds, pond construction and maintenance, which was really interesting because we'd like to put in a little pond here. So we'll probably play that sometime in the summer when we're super busy. When we've worked all day. And then there's another one coming up that we're going to record in a couple weeks about pond plants, I think. I can't remember the exact title of it, but we'll go record that one as well.
And at the library, we started talking to the guy that sat down behind us, Doug, who then we started talking about how he is setting up a new bee club, like honeybees, in the area. And I found out that one of the people attending was going to be bringing a Woray hive, which I was interested in because I've read about them for probably the past 5 years, but have never purchased one or built one. And so I went to the bee club meeting and met some great people there, and also met a lady locally that runs a blueberry farm, an organic blueberry farm. And she was talking about she mentioned and brought some samples of her blueberries and different products that she has, and was talking about the health benefits of blueberries. Mm-hmm. And they're very much along the lines of elderberries, you know, those dark, lots of antioxidants, dark fruits. Right. So we might try to have her on the podcast at some point too. I mentioned it to her and she just thought that sounded great. So, it's been a busy week.
And we were in Boston on Friday. Yeah. We went down to meet the guy I work closely with at Ethel Gloves. So he happened to be in Boston, and since we're only 3 hours away, we drove down there to meet him. Because I mean, I've been working with him for. I actually started kind of working at Ethel right before he came, kind of right when they were recruiting him. So him and I have kind of been, you know, he's kind of my liaison there, and we chat all the time. And so it was kind of neat to finally meet someone that I've been talking to and working with for almost 3 years now.
Does your liaison have a dossier? We always love that about that when we watch shows on
the
BBC.
British TV shows, yes.
Here's the dossier.
Yes.
Yeah, and then had dinner with some friends last night. And
had a game night at a friend's house, so yeah.
But
now we're tired.
Now we're tired, and we're excited for a week of kind of normal...
Back to work.
...schedule activity. Yes, back to work.
Isn't it bad when you're looking forward to work because it's like time off?
What's like when we take a vacation? And
yeah, and you need to come home and have a vacation
Come home and take a nap. But here we are, and we're...
So, what?
What?
I'm trying to read your mind and see if you're moving on to the next thing.
Yeah, I was going to go on to the fail of the week.
Yes.
So the fail of the week this week has to do with our trip to Boston, because we left and...
We left early in the morning.
Mm-hmm. And we didn't want to keep the chickens and the ducks cooped up while we were gone all day. And they've been doing all right by themselves, kind of wandering around. Oh, and speaking of which, we got some new chickens. I don't know. We haven't mentioned that on the podcast yet,
No, but on the blog we did. No, I don't think we did.
Yeah, so we have some new chickens. So now we have roosters. We have two roosters. And the roosters have been keeping the ladies all together and wandering
roosters
around the yard.
Roosters are great. So. I mean, a lot of people don't keep them because they make noise, for one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have neighbors, you know, neighbors might not like it. I personally kind of like the roosters. I like hearing my neighbors' roosters, you know. But roosters definitely have a place when it comes to chickens. I mean, they do a great job protecting the flock. They kind of herd the flock. They keep them together. It's amazing the difference in our chickens, because when we didn't have a rooster, they just kind of scatter all over the place, which is kind of dangerous for them, because then there's one hen sitting over here, and sometimes they'd break up in groups of two, you know, so I'd have three or four different groups of chickens running around in different places. But those roosters, man, they keep the ladies in line, and they keep them in a big group pretty much. And there are two of them, and it seems like they're always on... One of them, at least, is always keeping watch, which is good. He sounds the alarm. So this morning, we heard the rooster or the chickens out there making noise. And Brian's like, that's weird. What's going on? So, and then all of a sudden, we heard a bang on the back of the house. And the cats took off running inside. So I went and looked out the bathroom window. And I saw a fox running from, like, kind of up by our garage. And then there were ducks flying, you know, ducks flying around. And the roosters were right out front, making a bunch of noise. And so we went out, and one of the ducks, one of the female ducks, kind of flew out front, and it's kind of a...
And another one kind of flew away.
Flew somewhere. We're not sure where she is. She's probably hunkered down hiding somewhere. Right.
Well, and the one that you found, she flew down the front hillside and landed on some black plastic that we had over a wood pile.
Yeah.
And you said that you even had trouble
finding her. I had a hard time finding her because, you know, she's mostly black and has a little bit of white on her. So this time of year, they're perfectly camouflaged. So
where to land. And
yeah, they're pretty smart. It's amazing. But it'd actually be safer for her to kind of, you know, fly up by the house. But, you know, that's... They do what they're... instincts tell them to do. So
now we're gonna have to... we've been planning on building an outdoor duck house and surrounding it with an electric fence, and we've also been planning on doing kind of a sort of a paddock shift system with our chickens, especially coming up in the summer as we start gardening. We're going to use them as our rototillers, since we don't do any tilling. So I think we're going to have to implement like an electric fence, not necessarily to keep them in because obviously they can fly, but more to keep the predators out.
Right. And because we've been thinking about and discussing getting a couple of real farm dogs, you know, that can, that would do the trick. You know, if you have a dog out there, the fox will
Lucy's
not be
not a real farm dog.
No, but if she were out there, you know, she would still chase a fox away. I mean, she did wonders with the squirrels back in Ohio. But, you know, she'll chase things. She does. I mean, when we brought the new chickens in, she was leery of the new chickens, but not our old chickens, because she knew they were different. And I saw her once catch a sight of like the rooster out of the corner of her eye and growl at it. And then she was like, oh,
yeah,
I'm not supposed to growl at that one, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, even she would be great, but we just need to have dogs that are outside and dedicated and do that kind of thing, if that's what we're going to do.
She's not very dedicated.
No. She prefers to sleep inside.
That's right. So,
but yeah, so, I mean, but that's one of those things that, I mean, I think that this can kind of tie into the topic too. It's just like us as humans. I'm not going to keep my ducks and chickens locked in coops all the time to keep them safe. Yeah, I'll probably never lose one to a predator, but what kind of life do they have? I mean, those chickens, if I don't let them out of their coop or their run, we have a coop with like an attached run on it. If I don't open up the door by 9 in the morning, they're just like screaming at me to get outside, you know? And when you see them out scratching around in the leaves, and you can just tell they're just happy as clams. And so, you know,
plus they're doing more good for us when they're out running around, scratching around, eating bugs
and ticks and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, there's that balance that you have to find between safety and, you know, safety isn't always all that it's cracked up to be, you know. I could never fly anywhere in order to never risk dying in a plane crash. I mean, even though it's actually driving is more dangerous, but, you know, I could stay at home and never drive anywhere, but what's the point of that, you know? So there's an inherent risk in everything that we do, and it's the same when you keep animals, you know. If you can't handle the occasional loss of something to a predator, you probably shouldn't have animals. But it's something, it stinks, yeah, it does, but I know that our ducks and our chickens are happy as can be, and I would feel much worse keeping them locked in. And I know that they're, you know, yeah, it's one of those tough things, but in the same respect, it's a risk that you take in order
There's a balance in everything.
Right, and you have to find, you have to protect them, but then, you know, not overprotect. And yeah, it's just one of those things that, and you can deal with the predators, fencing, dogs, you know, geese. We're getting some geese because they're a little bit better at being, they're big enough and they're a little bit better at sounding the alarm. And, you know, we're working on getting all of these things kind of implemented. It's a little rough in the beginning when you're trying to get everything going at once, you know, and you don't have everything implemented. And it just takes time to figure out traffic patterns of predators and what predators you're dealing with. You know, we don't seem to deal with hawks or owls or any of the aerial predators that a lot of people seem to have trouble with. But we've got the fox. That's probably going to be our arch nemesis here.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe that's, you can start hunting fox, you know, in the winter, you know.
Put on my little red jacket and white pants and bugle.
And yeah. And that, I mean, that's definitely an option, you know. It's just one of those things, because maybe the predator load is too high. You know, our neighbor has lost a lot of chickens to a fox. So I don't know. It's just one of those interesting things. You kind of have to figure out what works best. And, you know, for your particular situation, it's something you have to deal with when you have animals.
And those thoughts do tie into the topic tonight. So we played the organic orcharding episode last week, and we left there, after we left the library that night, we started to talk about organic and what organic means. And I know that with the organic orcharding discussion, and even the talks, some of the talks that we heard yesterday at the rural farm days or
Rural living days.
I can never remember the name for some reason. They would discuss organic, and if you go to the grocery store today, you'll see there are a lot of organic products and a lot of organic things that you can buy. And we'd always laugh when our friends would buy you know, organic chicken nuggets, because it's still a chicken nugget. So, you know, why not buy chicken? And not saying that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
But as we were leaving the library and discussing the organic orcharding talk, I said to Susie, isn't it strange? Because it seems like organic orcharding is the same as conventional orcharding, only using
quote unquote less toxic.
Yeah.
Insecticides and
pesticide or fungicides and
right.
and those types of things. And there is a difference, and there is a balance, and I think that one of the problems is, and I think I want to differentiate what we're talking about, because obviously, if you're running a business, there are going to be some considerations, some financial considerations,
mm-hmm.
because if you lose a whole crop, let's, you know, stick with the orcharding thing for a minute as an example, but this deals with everything. If you lose a whole crop, a whole year's worth of fruit, then you're in trouble financially. But in the same respect, if you're always having to apply organic pesticides or organic fungicides or, you know, all these different things, then that's also costing you money.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we want to talk about tonight is kind of our take on organic. And it's not, I think that our take on organic really goes beyond quote unquote organic into holistic management of mm-hmm. your garden.
And it's like holistic permaculture, organic kind yeah. of.
It's like all those ideas, we take the best of all those ideas and roll those yeah. into one. And I really think that the way that we're going to talk about this, we're going to kind of set aside commercial
yeah.
for a minute.
Right.
And a lot of these thoughts can apply in a commercial setting because they do. I mean, there are people out there that are using permaculture and holistic methods mm-hmm. in
and
order
biodynamics. Right. I mean, you know, you can't, it's hard to do organic grapes unless you do biodynamic. And as crazy as biodynamics is, if you've never read about it, I highly recommend it because it really seems just ridiculously crazy, but it works, you know. So I'm not going to say it doesn't. I mean, it's really, really fascinating to read about.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so there are people that bring kind of that aspect into it as well, and it does work in certain commercial settings. And I think it really, it just takes people to think outside the box, like the conventional method of doing things. And I think that that's part of the problem with organic, like, you know, grocery store kind of big organic is kind of like that. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of stuff, I think we're getting to a period in time where we have to start thinking outside the box, because eventually, you know, even organic methods quit working
mm-hmm.
because, you know, pests become acclimated to the insecticides and the fungus becomes acclimated to the fungicides that you're using, you know, and it keeps becomes cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not the answer because mm-hmm. it just keeps spiraling, and then you have to find something else and use something else. So, you know, I mean, when you break the circle, kind of, it's broken, and you're going to have to keep trying to figure out how to get it back together again, but it won't if you keep screwing around with it, kind of. That's like... Mm-hmm.
So let's talk through this a little bit, too, because obviously... You and I, and that's the difficult part about recording this show, is that you and I have the same thoughts. And so a lot of times, and this is a conversation really between us. So as we're talking, we have all these things in the back of our head, and we understand what we're saying to right. each other.
And we've spent a lot of time discussing this. And
right.
I mean, I've spent countless hours over the last, I don't know, 8 years reading about these kinds of things and observing what happens in my gardens and other people's gardens, and just reading hundreds and upon hundreds of scientific studies and mm-hmm. University Extension, you know, articles and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah. So
the first thing is that one of the things
this is kind of the foundation,
right?
I think.
Right. Is that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so explain that a little bit and then give an example.
Okay. So you have to remember that even in, okay, so say you're dealing with a pest mm-hmm. in your garden. If you do something to mitigate that pest issue, there is going to be the result you want, which is mitigating this pest issue. And then there are going to be other reactions or consequences in your garden that you might not understand. It's kind of like the ripple effect. Mm-hmm. Nothing ever in the garden exists in a vacuum. Because if you look in your garden, it is a complex web. There's that quote by, I think it's John Muir, that says, when you tug at one thing in nature, like everything else is connected to it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it is in our garden. And that comes with something as simple as like an aphid. You know, if you spray the aphids off of your roses, well, now the ladybugs in your garden might not have something to eat. Mm-hmm. So then they're probably not going to leave. They're not going to breed, or they're just going to die and not breed and not be able to complete the life cycle in your garden, which then breaks that cycle, which means the next time you have aphids, you're going to have to spray them off your plants again. And you're going to have to keep doing that because there aren't going to be any natural predators. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of like, and it's something as simple as like, okay, and like in the holistic or the organic orcharding thing last week, he was talking about spraying BT mm-hmm. and a lot of organic growers use BT because it's labeled an organic, mm-hmm. you know, insecticide, because it's like a natural, you know, some natural thing that blah, blah, blah. But the problem is that it targets the caterpillars. Mm-hmm. And when you spray BT on your broccoli to get rid of the cabbage loopers, it kills caterpillars. So you think in your mind, oh, well, it's just killing the, you know, and the bottles always say, hey, it works against 50 species of pests, but it doesn't tell you that it's also killing, I mean, that species, which is what, Lepidoptera, mm-hmm. is the largest order of insects. It includes moths, it includes butterflies. So when you're spraying BT on your broccoli, think about the monarch. I mean, why are we having issues with the declining population of monarchs? Could it be because even organic growers are spraying BT on everything? Mm-hmm. Could it also be because, you know, genetically modified corn produces its own BT, which it's been proven that the pollen from that corn is harmful to honeybee larvae? Mm-hmm. You know, the bees take it back to the hive and then they feed it to their, you know, the larva, and then it kills them. Of course it does.
Right.
Because it kills like the soft bodied insects. So, you know, I mean, you have to think about that. A lot of people don't. And of course, the bottles and the boxes of all of these chemicals will tell you that it kills blah, 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 blah. But they fail to mention that it also kills a whole host of other things.
Right.
So, I mean, and then often you also have to think about the fact that, so you're putting BT on your broccoli. I'm going to use this example because there are a lot of people I know of that use this. So you put it on your broccoli to kill the cabbage loopers. And say then your parasitic wasp then, because we, back in Ohio, we had parasitic wasps that would eat the caterpillars off of the broccoli and the cabbage and stuff. So say it comes and grabs one of those caterpillars that you just sprayed BT on, mm-hmm. takes it back to its little hive or its little nest or whatever, depending on what kind of wasp it is, and feeds it to its young. So its young is going to die now too. Or think about the wren, who also loves these little cabbage worms. Think about that wren that now goes and takes that caterpillar and tries to feed it to the young. Well, now it has BT on it. So, I mean, do we understand how that then affects the wren? And maybe it doesn't necessarily like directly affect, as in it's not toxic to them. But is that caterpillar as healthy then for that wren baby? Mm-hmm. No, probably not. And if you watch the life cycle in your garden, like if you just step back. So I always had, you know, the yellow butterflies laying eggs on the broccoli, and I had some worms in my broccoli and holes in the cabbage, and you know, I never particularly care, and some people hand pick them, you know, which is obviously the least toxic, but there are still consequences for that.
Because you're taking food away from the natural predator.
Exactly. So in my garden, I remember once, one year in particular, I noticed the cabbage loopers. And so I, you know, did some research, like, what predators are there? That's how I always start my, what natural predators are there for this particular insect that I'm seeing that's doing some, what I consider damage to my crop.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read, well, there are parasitic wasps. And so I started watching. And sure enough, I saw these parasitic wasps. And then, you know, but they didn't seem to eat enough of the caterpillars because I was still seeing some damage on my crop. So I was like, oh, I wonder what else there is. And then I read some more, and here, wrens particularly like these caterpillars. So we had wrens nesting in our wren boxes. I can't say that. And the little wren nesting boxes that we specifically put up to attract them, because they're just phenomenal aids in the garden. And then I started watching, and sure enough, the wren would come every now and then. But then I noticed all of a sudden there was just an explosion of caterpillars on the broccoli. And I was like, well, we're probably not going to have broccoli this year, because I'm committed to not dealing and stepping in with these things, because I know it's going to upset some sort of balance that there is. And wouldn't you know it, as soon as the population of those caterpillars just exploded, the wren babies hatched out. Mm-hmm. And so those wrens, just within like a week, no more cabbage caterpillars, no more caterpillars on the broccoli. Not a single one would you see. Because, and you know, it's timed that way for a reason, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the considerations you have to think of. So what if I had sprayed BT on all of my broccoli, or even hand-picked all of them off? So what is the wren then going to feed to the babies, to the baby wrens? You know, I mean, it's just, it's that simple, and yet that complex too, you know? And I think also, I'm trying to think of how to talk about this without going down too many wormholes, but then...
so to speak.
Yeah, so to speak. But then you also hear that vegetables nowadays aren't as nutritious as they used to be. So they have lower levels of vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. So why is that? Well, some people attribute it to soil depletion, which that can be the case. And some people attribute it to over-fertilization, which makes the vegetables grow bigger, therefore watering down the vitamins and minerals, which is probably also part of the case. But then there have been a lot of studies that I've read about, and particularly this one that I just read recently about how when this one I read was about soybeans. It said that soybeans naturally produce beneficial compounds only when they are confronted with serious stress. So, I mean, we also have to consider that maybe the pest isn't necessarily, I mean, it's nature is so complex, and we as humans think that we understand it, but it's so, we can never wrap our head around completely everything and how it's all connected. So, you know, your broccoli getting eaten by cabbage worms feeds the wrens, feeds the parasitic wasps, but then your cabbage plant that is having to deal with these stressors then makes your cabbage or your broccoli a lot healthier for you to eat because it's had to deal with the stress. So it's just like us in our lives. I mean, often some of the most stressful and most painful times in our lives, we grow the most, because that's when you kind of realize, you know, you take a step back, you look, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, you learn a lot in those situations. So,
well, and we're very much, I mean, as humans, we're like that. We want to solve the problem. Right. We see a problem, we want to solve the problem, you know, and especially when it comes to things like that, things that we're putting work into, we don't want that to be ruined. And so therefore right. we need something right. to take care of this right now and right away, you know, and right. we've put all this time and effort and energy into our gardens and we, you know, the reward of that is the vegetables. Right. So how dare you say that we, you know, just let the insects eat that. But
right.
there's a benefit to that because
Your vegetables are going to be healthier, and your the balance of nature might come slightly more back into balance. I mean, it's so out of whack with everything that's with all of the stuff that we step in and try to do. I mean, and part of it is that we're cultivating plants out of their natural habitat. You know, tomatoes aren't meant to grow in Maine. You know. So, yes, part of the issue is growing things outside of their natural climate, which makes them more susceptible to pests, you know, and diseases and all of that kind of stuff.
And another issue, too, is that many of the pests that we have in the United States aren't native.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not a native predator, but that does not mean that some of the native predators that we have will adapt to
exactly
take care of the
and that's what you
pests.
Can see happening, but the problem is that because we often step in and do something ourselves right away, and we use that as kind of our excuse to step in, well, these don't have natural predators here. Well, someone said that once because I wrote an article on my blog called Empty Shelves. You know, I mean, how many times would you go back to the grocery store if there was no food on the shelves?
Mm-hmm.
And the same happens in our garden. If we've got no quote-unquote pests, which I hate, like pest and beneficial, because those lines are so fluid, because a pest isn't a pest because it's beneficial for something.
Right.
Even a mosquito is beneficial because it feeds the birds and the bats and all of that kind of stuff. So,
which that one's just very tough for me to understand.
It is very tough, but we wouldn't have bats and hummingbirds if we didn't have mosquitoes. So, you know, I think that...
Well, and to kind of close that thought, what happened every year then after you left those pests for the wrens? We had wrens every single year in our garden.
Oh, yeah, everywhere.
And tons of them.
Yep.
So then we don't have to do anything after that.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like permaculture in that way, where you try to set up a system in order to do the work for you, or in order to minimize the amount of input that you have to put into it.
And I'll admit, it's hard. It's hard those first like couple years and of trying to get things back in balance, because our garden in Ohio was like the desert. It was like a desolate wasteland when we moved in, because the previous owners had used chemicals like you wouldn't believe. I worked in that garden for 6 years before I saw an earthworm.
Mm-hmm.
6 years. Adding mulch and green sand and other rock and mineral dusts, and adding charcoal to try to get rid of some of the toxic chemicals
and compost
and leaf litter and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I remember the first time I was planting something and I found a worm. I took a picture of it, of course. Yeah. And I think I came running in and showed it to you, because
that was one of your first ethyl glove photos.
Yeah. I mean, and it can take a long time I'm not going to say that you get things back in balance, because our gardens they're never going to be 100% balanced, because they're not kind of, you know, nature and the way nature does mm-hmm. things. You know, we can kind of create them that way and get them as close as possible. But, I mean, it does take time. And, you know, we're talking about the non-native pests, and that's kind of the same there. But the problem is that we're so quick to jump to, it's a non-native pest. There aren't any native predators. That means I need to do something about it. I'm the native predator.
Yeah.
But that's not the case, because nothing's going to learn to become a native predator if you don't let that happen. So like the Japanese beetle is a good example. You know, it's a non-native pest. So, you know, some people consider it a pest. The birds eat it. The chickens eat it. The moles will eat the grubs in the ground. You know, the robins and the birds eat the grubs if they see them. And then they've discovered that there is a parasitic fly. I think it's a fly that parasitizes now the beetles. So you're starting to see beetles with the little white eggs on their back. Mm-hmm. So if you allow things to, I mean, nature is amazingly resilient.
And has been for, you know, depending on the story you believe,
for a long time. And if there's a huge atomic bomb and say we all die tomorrow or whatever, you know, the world, everything kind of, mm-hmm. the zombie apocalypse, whatever you want. I mean, whatever your end of the world scenario is, we miss the Mayans. And of course, now the prophecy of the popes isn't going to work either. So can you tell we're a fan of post-apocalyptic? Whatever your end of the world scenario is, when we're all gone, I mean, how long is it going to take for nature to just kind of, yeah. take over and find its own balance? And I mean, that's the thing. I think that we believe that because we have these, you know, amazing brains,
right.
that we can figure it out and we know better, but we don't.
And I mean, as of 500 years ago, we thought the world was flat.
Yeah. And we have, so. We have such a limited view of how everything is connected.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the, it just, like, left me.
Well,
that tree, that variety of tree, there was a disease going around. They're almost all dead.
Elm?
No.
Emerald ash?
No. Anyways, so yeah, but then everybody cut down all the trees because they're great trees. I don't know why I can't think of the name of that tree.
I'll get it here in a sec.
But
I bet everybody at home listening to this is yelling.
Knows exactly, yeah. But so everybody went out and cut down these trees because, oh, well, then, you know, I think the United States Department of Agriculture or Forestry or whatever was even telling people, because I was talking to my dad about this and he remembers this because he was, you know, he wanted to be a forester back when he was in high school. So he was really, you know, in tune with all this stuff. And he said, oh, yeah, they were telling everybody to go out and cut down their trees because they were just going to die anyway. He said, you know, what if people hadn't cut down all the trees? There would have probably been some that survived the blight,
mm-hmm.
and they would have seeded down, and then they would have produced a blight-resistant variety of this tree. But because everybody went out and cut it down, now the tree is practically extinct. So,
elm? Did I say elm?
I think you said elm. Was it elm? I didn't think it was elm.
Dutch elm disease?
I don't know.
I'm looking on Wikipedia. Sorry.
Anyway, Barbara Kingsolver talks all about it in one of her books, in the Poisonwood Bible. No, not the Poisonwood Bible. The, anyways.
Chestnut?
Maybe chestnut. Yeah, it might be the chestnut tree.
Yes, the chestnut blight.
Yeah, so it was the chestnut. Maybe it was the chestnut.
I don't know. It was a tree. I know the one you're talking about.
But anyways, you know, I mean, and that's the thing, is that's the kind of thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have such a narrow definition of pest and disease, especially like disease. And we can even talk about this as disease, like plant disease and animal disease and human disease. We have this narrow view and see it as a bad thing, but it's not really, it's not a bad thing necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, because they're almost always, you know, there's a reason that it's happening. So let's look at like when you get a cold,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah, it kind of stinks. It's annoying to have a cold. But how do we know that having a cold isn't somehow preparing our immune system, a cold or a flu, for something later on down the line? I read an interesting book about a guy who, his belief is, he's a doctor, and he believes that when you get the flu or like a really bad cold, it's your body responding to some like weird toxin or like some free radical or something in your body. And he believes that's how your body helps fight cancer. And he thinks that one of the reasons, I mean, that's one of his things, one of the reasons that cancer rates and other kinds of diseases are increasing is because people are always trying to not get the flu. And when they have the flu or the cold, they take all kinds of medicines to
minimize
all of the immune responses, which mm-hmm. is the way he believes your immune system builds and gets stronger and bolsters itself in order to fight off some of these things. So his belief is that, you know, if you get the flu, you should kind of let it run its course, do some things that maybe help
stay hydrated,
make you more comfortable,
kind of things, yeah.
drink
yeah.
tea, you know, take some astragalus, things that help your immune, like things that help your immune system do its job better, mm-hmm. breathe some steam, you know, things that help make you a little more comfortable, but no, don't necessarily suppress the symptoms that mm-hmm. you have, because he said that might be your body fighting off like a little cancer cell that has started, mm-hmm. Which is a fascinating theory. I mean, I think that he's probably, I mean, I don't know if it's cancer or whatever, but I think that he's probably right that our bodies, you know, we have this weird view of germs and all of this kind of stuff, and nobody wants to get a cold. And, you know, when you get a cold, you take all of this stuff so that you can still go to work and so that you can sleep and, you know, all of that. And I don't know. I think he has a little bit of, he might be onto something there. Because we just never know. You know, we have such a limited view of everything. And I think that proof enough has to be, I mean, how often do you hear, oh, well, we're sorry, but this thing that we told you to take for this was actually killing you. So right. now, you know.
So now do I the mean, opposite or don't take that. Or
and there's, so, yeah, and everything's always, they tell you to eat this because it's healthy. And then they're like, oh, well, no, that causes cancer. Sorry, you know. Mm-hmm. And actually, usually they don't come out and say sorry and tell you to quit eating it. They kind of brush it under the rug and then just
or
tell you
to come out with something new for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, and then just
instead.
Tell you to eat something else. But so, I mean, I don't know. I think it, and I think the same can be true of plant diseases. I mean, the whole thing with plants that deal with stress are healthier, you know, and have more nutrients and have more vitamins in them, and are healthier for us. I don't know. It's one of those, like, it's such a complex issue.
But we don't like complex things, so we
no,
simplify
we like
them.
It to be easy.
We want to understand everything and understand why it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But
oh, and I'll give you another good example. Okay, and these are my favorite things to discover, because this is kind of my mindset. My mindset is always to just kind of step back and see what happens. That's what I do. You're not going to find me stepping in and spraying baking soda on my squash that has powdery mildew. I'm just going to let the plant die. And I'm probably going
to... Plus you're too busy to spray baking soda.
Exactly. And I'm going to grow, you know, 15 different kinds of squash. And one of them's going to do great in my thing. So that's what I'll grow again. But anyways. So, for example, I was reading an article about... earwigs.
Oh.
It was something popped up on the Organic Gardening Facebook page about the 10
earwigs
pests.
Earwigs are nasty.
So I always read these articles because, and I always just fume and yell, you know, like, are you kidding me? So in this one, they talked about earwigs and they were like, oh, earwigs are nasty.
They are.
And they're going to,
scary looking.
You know, whatever. They're eating your crops. Well, earwigs can eat your crops, yes. However, earwigs will also eat like the codling moths that are going to attack your apples.
Mm-hmm.
So... let's think about this for a minute. Maybe earwigs are attacking your crops because you've been killing all of the caterpillars, so they have no other food.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and I think it's interesting. We assume that they do that. Earwigs also eat aphids. So you want earwigs around because then they're going to help eat the aphids. They also eat other kind of pests. You know, they're kind of like an omnivore. So they'll eat plant material and other insects.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's one of those insects that people see as, most people see it as a completely negative thing and try to get rid of it. And you can, if you Google getting rid of earwigs, you're going to find so much information and so many people complaining about them. If you Google like benefits, you're probably not going to find very much information because you have to spend a lot of time searching for them. And I have just happened to stumble upon a few different articles here and there where, like, scientists have tested 14 different species of insects and what eats, like, the coddling moth. And one of them happens to be an earwig, and they mention it in this big article. So, I don't, it's just one of those.
Well, and another problem is that in all these things, and another view that we take, I guess, and another big part of our philosophy in general is that if there's a product to be sold behind whatever the problem is, then you need to really take a good look at that. So going back to your cold example, you know, cold and flu medicine and all that type of stuff. I mean, that is a huge industry. And so is all of the chemicals that are associated with, you know, insecticides and
it's a big business.
It's a huge business. And so, of course, you know, nobody wants you to know, or they don't want you to know what the benefit is, because then you won't buy their product.
And I mean, you know, I love a good conspiracy theory. What if they know that it causes, that it also then causes issues with the predators that prey on that? So if you look at, I remember one of the blog readers was having trouble, one of my blog readers was having with trouble with slugs. So she was going to buy this quote unquote organic slug thing that was supposed to kill the slugs. So I did a little bit of research on the insecticide or the poison that was in it. And of course, that ingredient, even though it's quote unquote organic, the ingredient that kills the slugs is extremely harmful to fish, amphibians, and birds. Who eats slugs? Fish, amphibians, and birds.
Right.
So your toads and your frogs are going to be, and your birds are going to be eating slugs in your garden. So if you're sprinkling them with this insecticide or pesticide organic, or whatever it is, even if it's organic and quote unquote non-toxic, it's still, so you put it on your slugs and say you happen to have one toad in your garden who just hasn't procreated yet, and that's why you have too many slugs, because, you know, he hasn't found a lady friend in order to make more little tadpoles. So next year you would end up having as many toads as you need to control your slug population, but you can't wait, so you put this whatever it is on your slugs. This toad then eats the slugs you put that stuff on, and he dies. So how long now do you have to wait for another toad to show up at your garden? And what's the slug population going to be like at that point? Or, you know, how is it going to get out of control because of that? So, I mean, that's, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing that I want people to understand, is the,
that every action
has an equal and often
opposite,
exponentially larger consequence that is often the exact opposite of what you want to happen. Because so often the thing that you're trying to poison or get rid of, and even non-toxic organic pesticides are poisoning, or, you know, ripping out the insides of these caterpillars or whatever, it's also having a consequence for the things you want around. You know, birds in particular are extremely sensitive to toxins and poisons. I mean, do you really want, so much so that you're not supposed to paint your birdhouses because the VOCs can kill all of the little baby birds in the birdhouse? I mean, they're extremely sensitive to this kind of stuff. So anything you put in your garden, if you think, I mean, birds eat almost any kind of insect. So anything you put in your garden, you're at minimum hurting the bird population. You know, and birds, the bird population is in decline, and it has been for a long time. And a lot of people blame cats and all kinds of other stuff. But most likely it's the fact that everybody is poisoning every single thing that crawls in their garden,
including their lawns and everything else.
Everything. I
mean, how many people, not speaking of organic, but how many people you know, use chemical fertilizers in their lawns. Mm-hmm. And what does that do to the earthworms?
Yep.
Which then, what do the birds eat?
Right.
Which
then, there was that, there's another great, here's another great example. So I think it was in Michigan. A lot of these things I've read, you know, a long time ago. So I'm pretty sure it was in Michigan. Was it in Michigan? Yeah.
There we'll was, say Michigan.
Yeah. There was some sort of an issue with this tree. I can't remember what kind of tree. Maybe it was an oak tree, or maybe that was the one out in California.
Oh, brother.
Anyway, so there was this issue with this tree. So they sprayed the trees with something, right? Well, you know, in the fall, the leaves fall down on the ground. So they noticed the next spring, all the robins were dying. And they had no idea why. So they, of course, brought in a scientist to figure out why all the robins are dead. They probably thought it was like the bird flu or whatever. So here come to find out, all of the robins had been poisoned. Mm. And it all linked back because the leaves fell on the ground. You know, they crunch up and then the worms eat them to work them into the soil. The birds eat the worms. And then the birds are poisoned. Mm-hmm. So how much pesticide residue, or I'm not sure if it was a pesticide or like a fungicide, I mean something like that, mm-hmm. how much residue is on that leaf after a season, mm-hmm. after the leaves compost into the ground, and then the next year the birds eat them and they all die. I mean, that right there is just crazy when you think about it. And here's another great example. I'm pretty sure that this one was in California. And I think, I'm trying to remember, I really need to start keeping notes or try to find these articles again. It was some town out there that was having trouble with the webworms. You know, those worms mm-hmm. in the summer that form those big nasty webs on your, in Ohio, that it was always the wild cherry trees. Mm-hmm. That's what they preferred. And they would defoliate the tree. You know, the worms would be, they're kind of fascinating to watch. I have some really great pictures of them. So the worms, you know, eat the leaves off the tree, and then they kind of, some of them fall out of it, and a lot of them end up dying in the web. Mm. And I noticed that the birds will eat those in the winter. They're like dried mealworms almost. So good for the birds there. Anyways.
Which is one benefit.
Which is one benefit, yes. And that benefit alone should be enough. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It gets better. So in California, they had these webworms, of course, and they were all worried because they were defoliating the trees. And they were all worried that because with the drought conditions, these trees weren't going to make it because they didn't have leaves. I'm not sure why they had this mindset, because these were not like idiots. These were, you know, people with scientific backgrounds.
People with edumacations.
Yeah. So they decided to spray and kill all the webworms. Mm-hmm. So they sprayed and killed all the webworms. Well, all the trees then the next year showed signs of significantly more stress, and a lot of them died. And then they did a little more research. Well, here come to find out, as long as the webworms are around, they defoliated the trees, and then the trees then lost less water because they didn't like
evaporate the water.
Exactly. They didn't transpire that water out of their leaves because they didn't have the leaves. That's kind of like spraying your Christmas tree with anti-transparent wax, which is like it'll seal the needles so they don't lose the water through the needles. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's this, if the tree doesn't have leaves, there's no way for it to transpire the water out of the leaves. So these caterpillars were actually worse in drought years, and they were preventing the trees from getting rid of losing too much water. So inadvertently, when there was a really bad drought year and they killed all the caterpillars, they ended up killing all the trees, even though they were trying to save all the trees, because they didn't fully understand the process that was happening. Mm-hmm. So unintended consequences, and it's been proven over and over again, and it's just one of those things that you really need to think about before you step in and do anything. And I talk about this all the time. It's something I'm extremely passionate about with people, and I'm sure some people have alternate views, which is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, if you feel the need to handpick cabbage loopers off of your broccoli because you don't want worms on your plate when you eat broccoli. You know, it doesn't bother me if there's a worm on my plate when I'm done eating broccoli. It's not a big deal. Typically, it does not turn my stomach. But I also grew up eating ants, so eating fried ants. So a worm is like a special bonus to me.
Extra protein.
But, you know, I just check it in the compost pile or at that point. But I don't know. It's just one of those, I don't know. It's hard to.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get this point across sometimes because so many people feel like they have to do something. So let's talk a little bit about what you can do or what I recommend doing, because this is clearly, you know, just things that I have studied a lot and read a lot and things that I have found to be true in my, I always feel like I've only been gardening for a year or two, but I've actually, it's like the, you never feel like you're getting older.
Mm-hmm.
Things that I've noticed in the last, geez, it's been like 14 years now. Mm-hmm. In the last 14 years of my experience, mm-hmm. I would say. So.
Well, and the hard part about this too is that it's definitely a paradigm shift for most people, because most people, you know, like I said, if there's a problem, then there's something to fix it. Mm-hmm. And it's just like that with medical conditions. If we have an ache or a pain, mm-hmm. we go to the doctor and we get a pill, and that takes care of the ache or the pain. But is it really taking care of the core of what the problem is?
The root of the problem.
Or is it just taking care of the symptom? And that's what all these things that you're talking about in the garden, they're all symptoms of something. So mm-hmm. what is that something?
Mm-hmm.
And so That's what you're going to suggest. Right.
And I'm going to say, what can you do? Focus on building soil.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to do something in your garden, focus on building good soil. Focus on building the microbial activity, because that's like probiotics for your body. I mean, you hear all the time and you know, eat fermented foods and yogurt and all that kind of stuff, because it really helps with disease and all that kind of stuff. It's the same for your garden. If you focus on building a really good foundation so that your plants are as healthy as they can be without being over fertilized, because a lot of people kind of go to the extreme and over fertilize everything, which actually is detrimental in and of itself, because then you have more pest problems, because then your plants are like the candy store.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to just the groceries, the vegetable portion of the grocery store. So focus on building just that foundation. I always say that gardeners actually grow soil and not plants,
mm-hmm.
because that's where you should be spending the majority of your time, and your focus is on reading about good soil. Maybe read things about no-till gardening, read about the soil food web, read about rock and mineral powders, really study your soil and look at your soil and notice which plants in your garden. Like if you have 5 broccoli plants and one does better than the other, notice if it's on the one end of the row, like is the soil different there? Is there a little more clay? You know, notice that kind of stuff. Is there more mulch around that plant? Notice those kinds of things and spend your time, instead of worrying about aphids and cabbage loopers, focus on the soil, because a healthy foundation and like a low toxicity soil work on getting rid of any of those crazy residues if you've used chemicals in the past or previous owners have used chemicals. Focus on trying to get rid of that and bringing everything back into balance, and it really all starts there.
Well, and just like with diseases, colds, flus, that, you know, they always attack the young and the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
It's the weak.
Mm-hmm.
And if your soil is crap, and then your plants are going to be weak, mm-hmm. because they don't have that good foundation. So by building that up, you get stronger plants, which then can naturally resist some of these pests, or maybe not resist them, but maybe bounce back. So, you know, a pest comes along that eats some leaves off of it. Well, if you have good soil, lots of minerals, you know, then it can bounce back from that, regrow those leaves, and continue on, no problem at all.
And don't fight against your soil.
Mm-hmm.
So if you live in an area where the soil is extremely acidic. Don't try to fight that and keep, I mean, you know, you can sweeten it a little bit, you know, add some ash from your wood burner, that kind of stuff. But don't be adding all kinds of stuff every single year to try to sweeten that in order to grow plants that like it sweet. Grow acid-loving plants instead. Mm-hmm. There are lots of it. I mean, most plants don't mind it being a little acidic. But you can grow beautiful things that people with sweet soil can't, you know. Your hydrangeas are going to be a lovely color of blue that other gardeners, you know, envy mm-hmm. who have sweet soil. So, and that's another thing. Just kind of work with what you've got and don't fight it.
Well, and thinking differently too about how you grow mm-hmm. because so if you do want to grow something that needs sweet soil, then maybe container gardening or yep. maybe a raised bed
you can do a raised bed and have like a sweeter soil in there mm-hmm. and do all your sweet loving plants there. I mean, that would be a great way to do it, and it'll probably eventually, like, you know, your plant roots are going to grow down and bring up some of the acid and that kind of stuff. That, you know, nature has an amazing way of kind of balancing itself out, and eventually mm-hmm. that soil in that raised bed will probably become acidic. But, you know, you can have some sweet living plants for a while, or dig out the soil or do another raised bed and then just use all the compost back in the soil.
And just like with our health too, I think you need to one of the reasons that we eat the way we do and eat the things that we do is not necessarily that we like the things, but because they're good for us. So you mm-hmm. were talking about fermented things and, you know.
Well, we can talk about juniper.
Yeah.
Because tonight for supper, we had a venison roast with root vegetables, and I had put juniper in it.
Which is traditional.
Which is very traditional.
And we had it before, and it wasn't, we could barely taste it. So right. You put more in.
I put a little more juniper in, and I put a little less other herbs in it. So juniper is very traditional with game, which is why I put it in there. So we were eating it, and it was, you could taste the juniper. I'm not a huge fan of the flavor of juniper. It's just not my favorite. Mm-hmm. It's not that it was bad meal. I would prefer thyme and rosemary, you know, and some smoked pepper and that kind of stuff with my roast. Some red wine.
As she's picking out the juniper berries, because there were so many in the meal, she said, I'm going to go grab my herb book and find out how good these are so that I'll want to eat them.
So I grabbed my book
during dinner,
Medicinal Spices, and we read all about the wonderful things juniper berries will do for you.
And I ate all but three of mine.
And I ate most of mine as well. So, you know, I mean, sometimes it's not necessarily about eating the things you... And it's not that juniper is bad. It's just right. not my favorite thing. I would definitely choose other herbs over it. Mm-hmm. But it's good to have a mix, and it's good to have it. So, yeah, that's one of those... That's kind of one of those things.
Right. So being preventative about the things that you're doing rather than reactive
right.
yep. is definitely
right.
not only a smart thing, but sometimes the easy thing.
And you can also change your mindset. We talked about this in one of the earlier podcasts. I can't even remember which one it was, but changing your mindset about things. So instead of focusing on, oh, I can't believe the aphids are eating my roses, say, oh, look at that. The ladybugs are going to have a feast when they show up. You know, I mean, just something as simple as that will really help you kind of shift your perspective and think about things, you know, a little bit differently. And I would also recommend just sit back and watch. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating once you do that to see if anything, even if you lose all your squash to squash bugs are incredibly entertaining and fascinating to watch. I'm serious. They're like little, I mean, they're hilarious. They're kind of like little Martians. I mean, they're really interesting. I always saw some big squash bugs back in Ohio, but we had a ton of big wolf spiders in our garden. And they were just, I mean, they were voracious, very voracious guys. So they pretty much, any squash bug I saw was already caught by a spider. But when we moved here, there were a bunch of squash bugs on one of the pumpkins out in the out in the garden back behind the house. And mm-hmm. I just loved going back there. And if they see you, there'll be like a group of them. And they'll be about, I don't know, the size of a lens cap to a camera lens, you know. And they all move in unison. They're kind of like ducks. They're like gray and they have these little black wiry legs. And they're really interesting. I mean, if anything, enjoy the uniqueness and the interestingness of all these insects and just the intricacy of nature. If, mm-hmm. you know, instead of eating squash, enjoy seeing something while it ruined your squash. It's still beautiful in its own way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, observing. I mean, and you'll notice once you sit back and do that, you'll notice like I did about how the population of the cabbage caterpillars peaks right when the wrens hatch out. You'll start to notice things like that, and then it kind of starts to click. Mm-hmm. And then the more you notice, the more you observe, the more things like that you'll notice. So yeah, but we should also talk about now that we've wound down pests that you can't, that aren't kind of part of this, where there are no natural predators. So like deer in Ohio.
Right.
I mean, there are certain kinds of pests like that. If there are no natural predators, you're going to have to deal with either a barrier method, like putting up a fence, or like back in Ohio.
Or a shotgun method.
We had, yeah, yeah, it works. That's, right. A good way to deal with some of these problems, you know, because humans often are, in some instances, because of population density, right. We have gotten rid of all of the predators and therefore we are the only ones left. Right. So we need to, if we are going to push out all the other predators, then we have to be able to assume that role in order to balance out the species for the health of it. So let's talk about chipmunks. Because when we lived in Ohio, when we first moved into Ohio, we had beautiful woods behind our house, and we had a couple of big great horned owls. We never saw a chipmunk or a mole or a mouse or anything, but we would see these big owls sitting in this big oak tree right by our house. And they timbered that woods. And then the owls moved away because they didn't have good habitat. So the chipmunk population exploded that summer.
Yeah,
it was ridiculous. So much so that they started burrowing by the foundation of our house, and we started to have trouble with getting water around it. And so we were at the point where we had to do something. And then, of course, all of a sudden, we started noticing a ton of stray cats, or feral cats, actually. Mm-hmm. They were like completely wild cats, not people's pets they dumped off. Feral cats. And then this one called Miss Mama moved some kittens into our garage. And wouldn't you know it, that cat, we saw her one day catch 6 chipmunks or 7. Mm-hmm. A bunch of chipmunks. She fed them to her kittens. Once she moved in, it balanced out the rodent population. We didn't see mice before that, there were just tons of moles and voles in the garden. And so she kind of helped to balance out that rodent population. So she moved in and filled in the void where that great horned owl had moved out, because he wasn't going to be able to catch. Mm-hmm. He wasn't going to stay. And so, I mean, sometimes it's, you know, a lot of people complain about cats eating birds, and they do eat some birds. Personally, our cats, I rarely see them eat birds. They typically go for the rodents and the chipmunks and the moles and that kind of stuff. And if you don't have the natural predators around, they can be extremely beneficial in those regards, especially if you live in a area like we do here with the deer ticks and the Lyme's disease. Having something that's going to help control the rodents is extremely important, and definitely one of those gaps you don't want to have in your predator prey area. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, but if you live in an area where you don't have that, you need to think about ways to deal with that, because you're not going to have the natural predators. So like groundhogs, if you live in a city and you've got groundhogs, you're probably not going to have coyotes or whoever is going to eat those groundhogs or the big hawks or any of that in your little backyard garden. So then you need to deal with a barrier method. And I would recommend barrier or finding a way to deal with it. Don't trap it and go turn it loose on someone else. That's
great.
That's illegal actually in a lot of states, and you're making, you know, the animal's most likely not going to survive anyways. So that is not a humane way of dealing with an issue. I highly recommend you not do that. Barrier method, or find, if you live in a rural area, find a local hunter that can come help with some of the issues if you've got them, or I mean, that's something. Sometimes you have to become the predator in those situations where there are no natural predators.
But make sure that that's not the first line of defense.
Exactly.
Because there are, especially when it comes to the insect world and smaller things, because everything that you talked about just now was larger animals that we have removed the predators for.
Exactly.
And so, and that should illustrate the problem, right? That we've removed the coyotes, and we've removed wolves and bear and, you know, all those larger animals. So therefore, we have these problems. We have these pests.
We have groundhogs and weasels and, you know, and mice, you know. I mean, the coyotes eat mice like you wouldn't believe. And, you know, people hate coyotes for some reason because they, you know, some people think they kill dogs. Well, they do sometimes.
But that's kind of...
But that's also part of the problem, where we've gotten rid of a lot of the habitat for the food that they normally eat. So, I mean, this is all part of kind of the same issue. And because of that, you know, I mean, if you live in a city, you're going to have deer. You're not going to be able to deal with that, you know. There's not going to be a natural predator except for it getting hit by a car, which is very unfortunate, or disease. I mean, disease is a pretty big problem for overpopulation, like in overpopulated animals. So you're going to have to deal with it in a different way. But I mean, that is all part of the same issue, because we step in and know better, and it kind of messes things up. But sometimes it requires us in certain situations, like the rodents.
And like the fox.
And the fox. This fox is just looking for some fast food.
Yeah, he is, because there's plenty of...
Because animals are expedient, too. Yes, you know, they'll take the path of least resistance, and it's easier for him to eat a chicken or a duck than it is for him to catch 25 mice.
Right.
And spend all day catching those mice. So,
just as it's easier for us to spray a spray than to let nature take its course and let the birds come in and eat our cabbage loopers.
That's right. So, yeah.
There it is. That's how we feel about organic. And like I said, we kind of went a little farther into sort of holistic management, permaculture, you know.
I think it's all about kind of developing your own. I mean, these are...
That's our philosophy. These are
opinions.
Everything.
These are opinions that I have reached through a lot of research and observation and reading and just careful, carefully watching what happens in my own garden. And, you know, you may not feel this way, but as long as your opinion has, you've reached your opinion through lots of study and
through thought,
and haven't just absorbed something you've read somewhere, as you know, you know, as long as it's something you've come up with through, then hey, have an opinion, you know. But this is just my kind of, this is kind of my thing, you know.
That's the way we feel, and that's how it is.
Yeah, and oh, there are so many good examples we could talk about. Just thinking about honeybees.
Well,
but
honeybees is a whole show in and of itself.
Yeah,
and oh man, I really
talk about non-native species.
Yeah, that's true. man, I really, after seeing that worry hive, I just I almost came home and said, listen, we're doing bees, but we just got so many things going on. I don't know if I can add that to our plate this year. Next year, definitely. And the funny thing is the worry hives are made. One of the other people I met is a guy up the road that does milling of northern cedar.
White cedar.
Northern white cedar. I knew there was a color in there somewhere. And he's like, oh, I should build these. And I said, yeah, you should, because I'd probably buy one off you. so, yeah, bees, that's an episode in and of itself sometime in the future. Because we really enjoyed keeping them and we'll keep them again in the future. So we'll be putting in some books of the week in the show notes, which you can find at cultivatesimple.com mm-hmm. that deal with this.
I will mention one and like, mm-hmm. I will give a, what is that called? A disclaimer, not mm-hmm. a disclaimer. So there's this book called Teeming with Microbes, which is really great. It's all about the soil, like the microbial life of the soil. And it's pretty simple. It's a lot less involved than a lot of like soil microbiology books. And it's a great book. I would highly recommend it. It talks about the soil food web in a way that you're going to understand. It can be, I don't know. Yeah, it's a good book, I would say. However, I'm going to say, I dislike one thing about this book. He talks in this book about the soil microbial activity and how it helps mitigate disease and particularly E. coli and all that kind of stuff. Like mm-hmm. What we see is bad diseases. I'm going to throw some quotes around that too. Growing up in South America, I have a completely different view of these things as well, since I've had most of them without issue. So he talks in this book about having healthy soil food web. You're not going to have issues with that. But then later on in the book, he says, well, but then I wouldn't add any kind of manure to my garden because, you know, I'd be afraid of any kind of bad microbes. Yeah. And I thought to myself, well, if you've got healthy soil microbial activity, it doesn't matter if you add manure because they're going to help balance all that out and mitigate any of that if it's in there. Not that I would add manure from like a CAFO farm to my garden, right. But you know, if you've got chickens, that's the only thing I dislike about that book is how he talks about that. But then he takes that like weird American germaphobe manure. Oh my goodness. You don't want to put manure on anything because it's poop. Oh my gosh. You don't want poop in your garden. So yeah, which actually, that's one of the best things for your garden as far as stimulating earthworm activity and like the soil food web. Definitely, if you've never put like animal manures in your garden, get some healthy chicken manure from a local farm, some healthy cow manure. That, when I took that step in my garden back in Ohio, it was like 5 or 10 years of doing just the leaf mold and the cover crops and the rock and mineral powders. I mean, I had more earthworm and like that, the soil food web, like the part that you can see, all those visible creepy crawlies that are fantastic. Putting chicken manure on the garden was one of the best and like the quickest things I ever did as far as enhancing that soil food web. So I actually would recommend not listening to that portion of this book and kind of whiting that out when he talks about that. So that's my one kind of,
well, and that's another overall philosophy that we have, is that take everything, and even what we say, I mean, take what we say
with a grain of salt.
Yes, whatever that, what does that phrase even mean?
I don't know.
Oh,
I like salt, so it seems good.
But research it for yourself. Find out for yourself. Develop your own philosophy.
Yeah, because, and take what we say that you like and disregard what you don't agree. You know, I mean.
Right. Yeah. Except for the part about the, you know, helping us out with support. I kid.
Yeah, so I'll do that book. And I'll think of a few. I have a couple of other good ones. I'm trying to think of some good ones that not a lot of books go along with kind of this ideal, though.
Right. And we can talk to Bill and Lauren about this and see kind of what mm-hmm. their ideas are for the podcast next week with mm-hmm. permaculture. Because permaculture is very much of that philosophy that, you know, you're setting up systems that that benefit each other and take care of themselves.
Like,
and
the Apple Guild, you know, you plant things around the apple, which I really appreciate that kind of thing. You know, for like, or I mean, I don't even want to call it organic. It's like holistic orcharding. Mm-hmm. And you have to be really careful. Another thing about quote unquote, like organic, if you're at the, and this is the problem with our extremely, everything's commercialized. You have to be so, these labels just get watered down when corporations get involved. So when you go to the garden center and you say, you know, hey, this is organic. Well, organic has a completely different definition when it comes to garden material. Organic means like of natural materials, kind of. So manure from Kefal cows is organic. So you'll see Miracle-Gro organic garden soil, which is composted manure from Kefal farms. That's not something you want to be putting in your garden. And I would say that's anything but organic. Mm-hmm. I mean, these cows are fed GMO corn. These cows are given all kinds of antibiotics and hormones and all kinds of stuff. That's in their manure. That's in that soil. You do not want to be putting that stuff in your garden. Just because it says organic doesn't mean that it's organic. There's actually a really great video I'll put a link to in the show notes that it might help you understand how these terms are getting kind of co-opted by the commercial, anybody who wants to make money off of them. This video is particularly about like free range and cage free eggs. This video is all about that. It's a phenomenal video. I appreciate the video because of it's beautifully done from like a video standpoint, since, you know, we kind of do that. So it's phenomenal from that standpoint. It's phenomenal from the standpoint of talking about how these terms have been, what they mean. Buying a cage-free hen, a cage-free egg from the grocery store doesn't mean that that chicken was out like ours running around, running away from foxes.
running around soaking up the sun,
digging through the leaf litter and having a grand old time dust bathing underneath the porch. You know, this chicken was in a barn, crammed into a barn with a bunch of other chickens. It's not in a cage, but it's still crammed into a barn. So this video does a phenomenal job about describing, and that's kind of what I mean. That's why we talk about beyond organic, and that's why I have such a hard time with like the word organic and the label and like organic certification and buying products that are organic if they're not from someone that you know. There is a place for that in some regards when you don't, when you can't go to the farm and visit.
But if you can.
But in the same respect, it's also difficult. It makes it difficult for a lot of people to.
Which the whole organic, the actual label organic is a whole nother podcast because. And it's highly debated even within the organic farms and the, like in MAVCA, the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. That's even debated amongst, you know, board members and and within the ranks and within the farms. You know,
it's such a touchy, it's such a hard thing to do. Because, you know, legislation is difficult. Because everybody's got to get their, everybody's got to get their bit in there. And so the same goes with even small organizations like MAFCA and their organic labeling and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that's the too many cooks in the kitchen, essentially.
Well, when there's money to be made from something, it's bound to get corrupted.
It does get corrupted.
So, okay, I am stopping you. You cannot say anything more about this topic. We need to move on.
You know me. I could go on forever about this topic if it's someone will listen.
So listener questions. I'm stopping you. We only had one listener question this week, and actually I'm going to defer it. John, basically he's asking about honeybees, which is interesting that we have this one, this question in this episode. He said, you mentioned honey, and I remember a question I had about it. I live in the country and I'm surrounded by woodland and corn fields of corn. If I were to set up a beehive, would I be wasting my time since I know they spray Roundup on the corn? Great question. And hard to answer, because we actually had this happen to one of our hives back in Ohio, where we weren't, I think the field was probably a half mile from us, but bees will actually forage, some people say 3, some people say 5 mile radius. We knew the farmer had sprayed, and a few days later, about half of our hive died. So they must have been foraging from either something close to there or from that field itself.
And the problem is a lot of these chemicals are labeled, and this is another one of those things. A lot of these chemicals that farmers are spraying on their fields have the disclaimer that they're not harmful for honeybees. The problem is that you have to follow specific parameters to make it not harmful for honeybees. So it has to often be sprayed at very specific times of the day, like after the honeybees have gone in for the evening. I mean, it's just one of those things. And often farmers aren't paying attention to these rules, or they're mixing up their chemicals too strong.
Or they know, or they're just...
Or they just don't care. Just
have too many fields, or yeah. They just don't care.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's part of the problem, because most of these chemicals are supposedly not harmful to honeybees. However, all of our bees in one of the hives were coming back, and just like, I mean, we had piles of dead bees in front of the hive where they were just, and we knew it was, they had gotten into some sort of thing where someone had sprayed a field, or perhaps someone had sprayed one of their apple trees. I mean, it could have been something like that. I forget what time of the year. I think it was later in the year, so it was probably some kind of crop. But that's another thing you have to be mindful of. If you don't have bees and you have an orchard and you decide to spray for something, you could be inadvertently killing someone's honeybee if you're not paying attention to all of the specific nuances of the timing of the spray and all of that kind of stuff. So,
well, and not just honeybees too, but all the
mason bees, which are a bigger issue than honeybees. I mean, they're, you kill one of them and it's like killing almost a whole hive of honeybees. Yeah. I mean, they're just amazingly interesting.
So I said I was going to defer this question. John, a good place to look for information about honeybees and beekeeping in general is a forum called BioBees. And we'll put a link to it in the show notes. I believe it's biobees.com. And organic beekeepers on there. And just really good information. A lot of guys that are doing all natural beekeeping. And a lot of people, I shouldn't say guys, but a lot of people, I always use guys in the asexual sense. A lot of people that are doing organic, natural, completely natural beekeeping, you know, no medications, no feeding, anything like that. But also people that are doing, you know, more of a mixed approach, conventional. And there's also another great book called Natural Beekeeping that we can put in the show notes. But that would be a great one to check out.
That's a really tough issue, though, because
it is.
With bees, they forage so far.
You can't control them. You cannot.
No.
I mean, you can't say don't go that way or set up a barrier or anything.
But in the same way, it's really great because when you, and it's like anything else, it's good to do it yourself because you know exactly what goes in it. You know they're not medicating and doing other stuff. So at least you know your honey, while there may be some...
Something they're picking up.
Something that they're picking up. They're going to some sort of a field where it's sprayed with something, or it's a GMO crop or something like that. Probably most of the bees, other bees, are doing it as well. So at least you'll know that your honey doesn't have, you know, you didn't feed them high fructose corn syrup in the spring or that kind of stuff. So at least you'll know that you'll know exactly what goes into your honey, except for the, you know, there's that possibility, but there's that possibility kind of everywhere. So
with anything. I mean,
it's really difficult in most parts of the country to not have that issue. But honeybees really do end up, really do like tree pollen. So if you get a lot of trees around, you know, we lived by the woods, and that's one of the things they're going to choose over probably like BT corn pollen anyways. I mean, they're they're pretty smart about this kind of stuff. So if there's another option, they're most likely going to go to the healthier option, because a lot of times,
and I think the benefits of doing it anyway outweigh the mm-hmm. possibility, you know, the negative possibility. So I would say go ahead and do it. And I would also encourage you to check out a Warre Hive, and that's Warre. If you just do a search for Warre Hive, there's actually a great PDF online that gives the whole story and dimensions for Warre Hives. It's kind of a new thing. There's only two companies in the United States right now that are manufacturing them, and I'm trying to talk the guy up the road into doing it.
Yeah, so maybe you can buy a Chiotron Warre Hive here one of these days.
but it's a little bit more natural and sort of holistic way of keeping bees. But just something to check out. So John, I hope that answers your question. I hope that helps you out. So that draws the show to a close. I think this was a good one. I hope it got some information across, and like we said, just, you know, take what we say and add it to your thoughts and come up with your own conclusions and come up with your own philosophy. And it's like that with everything, you know, in anything in life, just think about what you're doing. That's what we want to encourage you to do, is be more mindful in any purchase that you make, in any food that you eat, in anything, going for a walk in the park. Just be more mindful. And that will help you to cultivate simple.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your hand. I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend. I'd rather do some thinking now. But somehow it all depends. If I could fly away from me, I'd rather see my hometown. I'd rather hold my wife. I'd rather never question things. That's the story of my life. I'd rather not be crying. I'd rather just be whole. I'd rather brave the cleansing fire. I'd rather feed my soul. If I could fly away from me to ride this wind above the tree. Open to suggestions. I'm crying out to you. I'm ready to be finished here. I'm ready for this season to be through. If I could fly to fly away from me, come and face the longing on my knee. Yeah, yeah, come and face the longing.